Up next, a very special person, Neil Donald Walsh, joins us. You might remember him, Conversations with God, so many other projects over the years. Now we'll be talking about a new documentary called I, God, as we continue with the theme right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, and Neil Donald Walsh back with us, modern-day spiritual messenger. His work has touched millions, friends, millions. He has written a number of books on contemporary spirituality. In the 20-plus years since he reported a very fascinating experience, and we're going to have him talk about that, and he's here also to talk about the latest called I, God, What Do You Believe?, something we've been trying to talk about for years. Neil, welcome back, first of all. Good to have you again.
Thank you, George. It's lovely to be here. You're very kind.
This question of I, God, what do you believe is, I think, at the heart of everything that's going on today. People are just trying to figure out, what is this? Who is this? How did we get here? Just the extraordinary that you would do this at this time. Perfect timing.
Well, I hope so. I have that idea that the timing is perfect. I hope the outcome is as good as the timing has been.
Yeah, exactly. Neil, to brand new listeners who may not know about you, tell us a little bit about the beginning, Conversations with God, because it changed your life at a point where something drastic needed to happen.
Well, my life, you're exactly right. My life wasn't working at any level. My career had fallen apart. My health was going rapidly downhill. My relationship with my significant other had ended. I mean, nothing really was working in my life. And I was just around 50 years old or so. And I thought, gosh, you know, this is not any fun anymore. I'm half a century on the planet, and I don't seem to be able to get anything right. You know, there was a time when I could understand at least one of the three might not be going so well. Maybe the relationship was a bit rocky, but at least the career was okay, my health was okay, or one of the other combinations. But here was the triple whammy. Every single aspect of my life was just falling apart and just not working. And I was furious, and I didn't know where to turn. I was very angry, and I woke up one morning at 4:30 in the morning, began walking around the house. I wound up sitting on the couch in the middle of the night, and I found a yellow legal pad on the coffee table in front of me, and just out of desperation, I began just writing an angry letter to the universe, I guess, an angry letter to God, if you please. What does it take to make life work? What have I done to deserve a life of such continuing struggle? And somebody tell me the rules, I can recall writing this. Somebody tell me the rules. I'll play. I promise I'll play. Just give me the rule book. And when you give me the rule books, don't change them. And at that point, I heard a voice over my right shoulder. And it was just as clear as a bell. I thought someone had snuck into the house. It's 4:20 in the morning. But I turned around. Of course, there was no one there. And then I thought, oh, terrific. Not only am I angry, filled with anger, but now I'm obviously going out of my mind. Except, you know, I was kind of intrigued by what I thought I imagined myself to hear. I heard a voice saying, Neil, do you really want answers to all of these questions? Or are you just venting? So, just to play along with the moment, I wrote on my yellow legal pad, you know what, I am venting, but if you've got answers, I'd sure like to know what they are. And with that, George, it was as if I had experienced just a download, just suddenly.
Bang.
Bang is right. It just everything, the answers to those questions came to me so fast that I began writing them down on the yellow legal pad, because I was fascinated by what I was hearing, if you please, in my mind. Now, the voice that I heard had moved inside of me, in my head, if you will. It sounded to me like the voice of my own thoughts, but I wrote down everything that I was, I want to quote-unquote say, hearing in my mind, and I wrote it all down, because never dreaming, by the way, that anyone else would ever see this. It was just, I was keeping a record because I knew how I would want to look at this later, so I kept on writing, you know, what I was hearing. Well, that process led me to ask more questions, of course, because what I was hearing in those answers was intriguing to me, and also it arose in me a great curiosity about other matters. So I said, well, what about this, or what about that, or how can that be true? But wait a minute, and I began arguing with this voice in my head, if you will, and that produce a dialogue, an on-paper dialogue that went on all night long until like 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and then every night thereafter for about 2.5 or 3 weeks, I would be awakened at roughly the same time, around 4:23 or so in the morning, and I would get back in touch, if I could put it that way, with this experience that I was having. finally, I wound up with many, many, many yellow legal pads, handwritten, question, answer. And again, it never occurred to me that anything was happening here other than that I was having a very personal, and frankly, to me at least, it felt like a very sacred experience. But then at one point in the dialogue that I began to find myself engaged in, it said, this will one day become a book. And I remember thinking when that came through, if you will, I recall thinking, wow, now I got him. Now I've got whatever this is, I've got him, because that was a statement of fact. Everything else I had received were statements of concepts, if you please, theories perhaps, but this was a statement of fact. This will one day become a book. And I thought, of course, that's measurable. I mean, either it will or it won't. So I thought, this is something that I can use to judge the experience that I'm having and perhaps use it as a measure of the validity of that experience. So I had the many, many pages of my yellow legal pads typed up by a stenographer who I knew, and I sent it off to a couple of publishers, just exactly the way I took it down. No editing at all. It was just exactly the way I received it, if you will, in my handwritten notes. And I sent it off to two or three, I guess it was five publishers of metaphysical spiritual books. And by golly, one of those publishers called me about 2.5 weeks later, and they said, we want to publish your book. And I said, you're kidding me. They said, no, this is fascinating stuff. Well, the rest, as they say, is to get into Triteville, is publishing history. The book, in fact, was published. It wound up selling over 1 million copies. It stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 2.5 years. And it was translated into 37 languages. And that wasn't the end of it. It was just in fact, the beginning of it, because while that process was taking place, the process of that book being published and distributed around the world, my internal process was continuing. So I wound up taking continuous notes, more and more handwritten notes, until I finally had what would amount to another whole book's worth, which became, in fact, Conversations with God, Book 2, and Conversation with God, Book 3, and it continued from there. 9 books, ultimately, in all, in the so-called Conversations with God cosmology. Now, I want to just end my little history lesson here with one final statement. I have no need for anyone to believe that I had a conversation with God. I have zero need for anyone to agree with me that was my experience. What I do invite people to do, however, is just take a look. Take a look at what came through. And if you find it intriguing, if you find it interesting, if you find it helpful or beneficial at any level at all, wonderful. Like anything else, any other kind of literature, spiritual or otherwise, terrific. And if you don't, then toss it out and throw it away. Because I have zero need for anyone to agree with the experience that I had. But what I notice is this. At this point, around 15 million people have agreed that at least, if nothing else, there's something of interest and of great value here in this dialogue. So, fair enough.
Fair enough indeed. Do you think at this point, Neil, that you are a messenger here to try to tell everybody something, or is this all being done for you personally?
Yes to both questions. And I think that we are all messengers. I've been told directly, by the way, in my conversation, that we are all messengers, and that our life lived is the message that we are sending to each other and to, if you please, the world at large. So the answer to your question from my perspective is, yes, I'm a messenger, as are we all, and yes, the messages were meant for me personally.
Now, you've created a documentary called I, God. You co-produced it with Robert Friedman, Jonathan Friedman, Matthew Friedman, and Rashmi Kilnani. This, tell me about this message. Is this an offshoot of Conversations with God?
Well, not in the sense that the theme of the movie revolves around conversations with God, only in the sense that the Conversations with God experience raised a question. What is a question we've been looking at, of course, for thousands and thousands of years, but what is true about God? And more specifically, at least, what do people think is true about God? We wanted to examine, the Friedmans came to me with an idea. Robert Friedman came to me with, he was, by the way, the first publisher of the first Conversations with God books. So he came to me and he said, you know what would be interesting if we just went around the country, and for that matter, in other countries, and just got people on the street and asked them, what do you believe is true about this notion that we have, that most of the human race has, about God, one way or the other. Maybe you don't even believe in it, but what is your thought about this notion that we call God? And wouldn't it be fascinating to see what these different people responded to a series of questions? And wouldn't it be interesting if we asked them all the same questions, the same six questions, and just compared one person's answer to another? And I think I added to that. I think I said, you know, Robert, what might be even more interesting is to do that, and then to ask the same six questions of clerics and members of the clergy around the world, of imams and rabbis and priests and ministers, and ask them the same questions, and compare what they're saying to what people on the street are saying, and see where the differences, if any, lie in that scenario. So they went ahead, in fact, and made that film, and they asked me if I would narrate it. I said I'd be happy to narrate it. But the film does not revolve around the conversations with God material or the experience, except broadly in the sense that it approaches the same subject of what is true, or at least what do people imagine is true about God.
You asked the question, Neil, if that people shouldn't have to be concerned whether you dealt with God or not in the beginning. How do we know that little voice you heard, that voice you heard, wasn't that internal us that tells us what's right, what's wrong?
Well, we don't know, and I'm not even sure there's a difference. I'm not sure
there may not be. You're right.
Yeah, between that internal us and the thing that people refer to as God, I have been reliably informed in the conversations with God dialogue that there is no separation between that which we call God, that which we commonly understand to be and hold as a thing called God, and the rest of life itself. That is, there's no separation whatsoever in the known universe. So that God and we are, in fact, one, if you will, and therefore, if that is true, and within that context, there'd be no difference between the collective us and the experience that we call God. I think that God moves in us, through us, as us, and I think that's true universally, that is throughout the cosmos.
This is the kind of documentary that the more you look at it, the more you're going to pick up information on it.
I think it's true, and I think what also is true, that and the more you look at it, at least in my experience, the more I look at it, the more I want to say almost shake my head, not in disapproval, but in kind of like a intrigue and in some level of surprise at the varying ideas and notions that people of different religions and philosophies have about God, and that we could be this far along in our apparently forward-moving evolutionary process and still not have solved or come to any kind of high-level agreement among peoples of the Earth. You know, there are something like 243 known religions on the planet. What's surprising to me is to hear the different ideas that people hold about God. But here's what's sad about it. Not only is it surprising, but what the film brings up for me is some sadness as well, because I realize, as I listen to these disparate voices explaining their idea about God, you know what? We're killing each other over these disagreements. This has moved far away from simply an intellectual conversation.
Yep.
Or a mental disagreement, or a philosophical, you know, misunderstanding, or even philosophical contrasts. These disagreements or these points of view that we're seeing expressed here in this film form the basis of mass murder and killing of people, and have for thousands of years. You would think we would have graduated from that at this point, but in fact, not only have we not graduated, we've actually receded and become more barbaric than we were before with regard to the differences that we observe between people concerning this aspect of life that we call God. So it's kind of like, it reminds me of what Bill Swing said, former Archbishop of California, former Episcopal Archbishop of California, William Swing, who said, in God's name, can't we stop the killing in God's name?
Yeah, we should be able to. What I find fascinating, Neil, is after every program that the word or name God comes up, I get a handful of emails from people that say, don't talk religion on your show. Stop it. And I answer them back, as many as I can, that we're not dealing with religion. We're trying to talk about what is this that is called God. What is it? And some of them get it. Some of the others don't.
Well, I experienced the same thing, of course. And what's interesting about that is not only did I experience the same thing that people, but before the book was published, and everyone wanted me, and that is everyone at the publishing company, wanted me to change the title. They said, you know, people are going to have a negative reaction, just as they do to George Norrie's programs. They're going to have a negative reaction if you're going to put a book out called Conversations with God. I mean, there's going to be an immediate pushback, and the book is going to go nowhere. I said, and they asked me to change the title, and I said to the publisher, you know what? If I have to change the title, then you're asking me to change my description of my experience. I'm not going to do that. Let's just not publish the book. I don't have a need for the book to be published, by the way, so just don't publish it. Well, if you're going to be that way about it, well, I guess we'll do it. I said, fine. The only way it's going to be published is if it goes with the title, Conversations with God, an Uncommon Dialogue. Well, then I started getting mail from people saying, you know, there's a lie in your book. I said, and I got more than one letter to that effect.
Yeah.
Many people, I said, what's the lie? They said, the lie is on the cover. It says an uncommon dialogue. In fact, many, many people this day and throughout human history have had the exact same experience that you have had. So it turned out that what the publisher thought was going to be a great big pushback turned out to be a title that sold in the millions.
It's just amazing, isn't it? If you look back, and for yourself personally, since this has happened, what have you learned from that moment you were in that very depressed, nothing's going on right mode?
Well, I've learned, first of all, that I was all wrong about life. Forget about God, just about the function of life itself on the planet, how it works, what its purpose is, if you will, how to move forward. You know, what the process is by which we create our own individual reality, if you will. I was totally wrong about everything, and it was just about every major aspect of life and how to proceed. And that's the first thing I learned was, wow, I was just doing everything wrong. Not wrong in the sense of morally wrong, wrong in the sense of it simply wasn't functional. I was leading and living an utterly dysfunctional life. And once I crossed the Rubicon and moved to the other side of that experience and began doing things that were not quite so dysfunctional, the dysfunction of the rest of the world, people around me, in my family, in my immediate circle of friends, in my community, in my nation, and then ultimately in the world at large, the dysfunction of people everywhere became very obvious to me. I found myself running around wanting to say, no, it's not like that. No, wait a minute, it's not like that. And that led to, you know, 20 years now of me being on the road. I've been on the road for 20 years doing, you know, going to China, to five cities in China in June. I'll be in Canada to do four cities in April. I'm going to Australia this year, Bulgaria, all over the place. Not bragging about it, just telling you that the sense that I have inside of me that, you know what, if I don't do anything else for the rest of my life, but just help people to see that we may not have it all right here. There's something we don't fully understand about this thing we call God and about this experience we call life. There's something we do not fully understand here, the understanding of which would change everything.
In a good way, are you obsessed with getting this message out?
I don't think I'm obsessed with it. That is not a word I would use, but I think I'm inspired to do so, and I think there's a difference between obsession and inspiration. Obsession to me,
sure,
feels like, you know, if I don't do it, I would be unhappy. I wouldn't be unhappy if for some reason I wasn't able to do this, but I am inspired to do it, and given that inspiration, I continue to do so as long as I'm able.
Why are people killing themselves over differences of what we should have, the same God?
Because they don't understand the whole purpose of having any belief in God. So they would kill, we have historically killed each other over our dysfunctions and over our utter misunderstandings about a pile of things, not just God, but social economics and social equality. And I mean, people kill each other. There are honor killings in countries because a girl went out and had a small kiss in a park with a young man.
That's,
I mean,
crazy.
And they kill people for that. So why do we kill each other for the wide variety of reasons that we do? Because we are simply an immature species, a primitive species. Humanity is. We're just barely in the age of the cosmos, half of a blink of an eye old, very, very young species, and we are acting like the children of the cosmos that we are. as we begin to grow and mature, and we hopefully can get further along in that process before we simply dissemble ourselves. But as
hold on for a second, Neil. We're at the break. We'll come right back. Neil Donald Walsh with us, and next hour we'll take phone calls with him. We'll be back. Sure is, with our special guest, Neil Donald Walsh. We're talking about all his works, including his new adventure into the documentary realm with iGod. And we'll talk more about that when we come back. Next hour when we take phone calls with Neil, I'm going to play you a short clip of the documentary to give you a little perspective of what it's like. Welcome back. Neil Donald Walsh with us. We're talking about the documentary iGod. Neil, for people who once believed in a God, but yet something tragic has happened in their family, in their life, maybe the death of a little child, and then they shun God, what happens? Because their question, and it's legitimate, is why would God do this to a little child or to this person? How do you answer that?
Well, first of all, you're of course right. Obviously, it's a legitimate and very fair question. Those kinds of sad circumstances, the tragedies that all people face, tragedies of wide variety, the death of a loved one, a hurricane that comes through and destroys everything in one's life.
Yeah.
I mean, why would God do any of those things? And the answer, of course, is that God is not doing those things. God does not get up in the morning, if you please, to characterize it and say, I think I'm going to, you know, visit this tragedy on this person. That isn't what happens. Life proceeds the way it proceeds, and events occur the way they are occurring. And I don't want to say randomly, but I want to say in a larger process to which we are not completely and totally privy. But it's not a process that God directs as one would direct a film or a movie, or as a scriptwriter would write and say, you know, on Thursday, Janet is going to have a very bad thing happen to her, mm-hmm. and Michael isn't going to do much better. This isn't how it happens. The what I would say to a person, first of all, let me tell you that I worked for a while in my life, almost 2 years, with a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I was a member of her staff. Some people don't know who that is, but she was known as the death and dying
yep.
lady.
She was a giant in her industry.
Yes, she was a giant in the hospice industry and a giant in many other ways. And I was privileged to be on her staff, work with her for 2 years. And she was asked this question all the time, of course. Why would God do this, or why would life allow this to happen? And she would answer this. There's a much larger process going on here. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy, including the possibility. And by the way, some of these questions were answered in the book that came through me called Home with God. Home with God in a life that never ends. So what I've learned from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is this: not only that there's a larger process going on, but more importantly, don't try to console or comfort or respond to questions like that from people in the moment or in the weeks and months immediately after something like this occurs. That is not a time for metaphysical exploration. That's a time for comfort, succor, help, compassion, caring, and healing. So what I say to a person, I would be sure not to say anything along these lines, philosophically or metaphysically, for many, many weeks, perhaps even many, many months. But then there might come up, but I would offer other kinds of help. I would offer my presence if I knew this person. I would offer my availability. I would offer, in fact, my compassion and my understanding and my companionship on the difficult days of this journey. But then at some point in time, I might invite that person, if you feel healed enough now, distant enough from this terrible, horrific experience, to take a look at it in a new way. Would you be interested in doing that? And if the person says yes, if they say no, of course, I say fine. You know, I have no need to convince you of anything or to take you to a place where you're not ready to go. But if a person says, you know, I really would love.
What confuses me, Neil, is because I accept that God doesn't create the death of the child. I think these things happen. It's the sad part of living. But then I believe in miracles where these incredible things happen. And so I question, why doesn't God step in and create the miracle and save the person? You know, we just had an earthquake in Taiwan.
20 people dead. They're looking for 100 people in an apartment that just totally collapsed. Why can't God stop it? Not create it, but stop it.
Because God's position, you know, is very much, I don't want to get really way out here now, but if you remember the movies, Star Trek, there's a non-interference clause there that we would not interfere with the product, process or the experience of any civilization. It's not God's job, if you will, to put a stop to things that are occurring, or to put a start to things, that is, to cause things to occur. If God had start-stop capability or start-stop desire, God would simply start right now by changing the whole world overnight.
Sure.
Forget about why God wouldn't stop the
hurricane.
Bang,
done.
Why wouldn't God just come right down at 12 noon tomorrow and bring instant clarity to 8 million people, 8 billion people? Obviously, God could do that. But it isn't God's position. It isn't the position of the highest wisdom in the universe to simply say this is what is, but rather to allow each expression of life, which we call souls in the human language, to allow each soul to experience and express free will and determination as they move through their life experience and bring themselves the encounters with life that would best move them forward on the process, the larger process that we call evolution. I'm going to say something very controversial right now, and I hope that people will forgive me if they're currently dealing with the loss of a loved one, because this is difficult to hear, but this is what I've been told. No one dies at a time or in a way that is not of their choosing. At a metaphysical level, obviously not at the conscious level, but at a metaphysical level, at the highest level of interaction with the energies of life itself, no one dies at a time or in a way that is not of their choosing. Therefore, no death is, if you please, wasted. And for that matter, death does not even exist. When we look more deeply into the whole spiritual encounter of the human soul and that expression of life that we call spiritual throughout the cosmos, we come face to face with a large question. Does death even exist? If the answer is no, I ask God, what is this thing called death? You're God, give me the definition. And God said, I'll be happy to. Death is simply life in a different form. It's simply a change of identity, nothing more and nothing less. You're simply identifying yourself in a new way, and you will continue to do that throughout all eternity as a living soul. So that altered my entire view. Not that I'm happy about the death of anyone, much less hundreds and hundreds of people in a natural disaster such as you referred to. However, I do come to a place of calm understanding that the life of those people has not ended, but simply changed form. I just had death in my own family. My father-in-law, my wife's dad, died just a few weeks ago, just before Christmas. And we've been dealing with this whole thing of death. And less than a week ago, we had the celebration of life service. We let a little bit of time go by between his departure and the celebration of life. But I spoke at that service. And there were over 200 people there. He was a widely known person in our community and deeply loved, not just by family, but a whole network of friends. And I stood in front of that room and I said, let us celebrate together today this gentleman's continuation day. And that's how I see death, is a continuation day, the continuation of life in a different form. That doesn't make it easier for us to accept or to embrace. You certainly can't be happy about it, but it does help us to understand that, oh, there is something larger going on. Shakespeare did have it right. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
So true. Now, biblically speaking, they blamed God for everything.
Of course.
The flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, every tragedy, every hate event, they blamed God for it. He was like a vicious, vicious God, wasn't he?
Well, of course, they had no choice given their limited ability to comprehend what was going on around them and to really look fully at life itself and the whole process of life. I made a comment a little while ago. Let me elaborate on that just a bit. If you take the age of the Earth and overlay it upon a calendar year just for purposes of scale, from the beginning of the Earth until this very moment on a calendar year. The earliest form of life single-cell life did not even appear until the end of February. More sophisticated life forms did not birds and fishes in the sea did not appear until the end of November. Dinosaurs did not appear on this planet on that scale until the 8th of December, nor did they disappear until the 25th of December. Humanoids did not appear until the 28th of December, and the entirety of human history occurred in the last 60 seconds of the year. That's how young our species is relative to the age of the Earth. Forget about the age of the cosmos. And that's how young we are today, not to even speak of the time that you just mentioned, where people blamed God for all the horrible things that were happening around them. Oh, of course they did. Because they were, and continue to be, infantile. And we use infantile understandings to describe as best we possibly can the mysteries of life that are going on around us. But things are happening. The evolution of humanity is, in fact, moving forward exponentially, not at a 1-2-3-4 rate, but at a 2-4-6-8 rate, 16-32, it's progressive, it's exponential. And so we find ourselves finally pulling out of those infantile days where we begin to comprehend, maybe there is something here that we don't fully understand, the understanding of which would change everything. And maybe God is not an angry God or a deceitful God or this horrible, horrible entity who not only allows these things to occur, but causes them to occur as a means of punishment or because God is angry. So we begin to emerge from our infantile understandings, our infantile holdings of this thing called God, and hopefully graduate to a larger view and a greater idea.
So with this belief that there is a God, which is goodness, what about evil? That exists too, doesn't it?
It sure does. What we call evil exists. Nothing is evil, lest thinking make it so, but what we call evil absolutely exists, and that's because we live inside of what I'm going to call a contextual field, where there is black and white, big and small, up and down, fast and slow, here and there, male and female, created he them, and the thing that we call good and evil. And the contextual field is part of a circular construction, if you please, of life itself in the physical form. In order to allow elements of life, sentient beings in this case, humanity, if you please, men and women around the earth, to know and experience, to express and become, to announce and declare who they really are. That is, in the absence of what you are not, what you are cannot be experienced. So to use a very simplistic example, and forgive me for being so simplistic, but if one says, I am the light, and I wish to experience myself as the light, one will pray for the most interesting experience as well. Bring on the darkness. Because in the absence of the darkness, the light cannot be experienced. You cannot know yourself as that. So if we wish to know ourselves as anything at all, to say nothing of the highest elements of what we call God, we are going to necessarily work together to create a contextual field that allows us to express and experience ourselves as not that. This is a very simplistic, very quick reading of why things happen the way they are and why there is such a thing as evil in the world. But mystics who have understood what I've just said to you have then said as well, judge not and neither condemn. Raise not your fist to heaven and curse the darkness not, but be a light unto the darkness that you might know who you really are.
In the documentary, Our God, do you try to tell us what God is?
No. In the documentary, we do nothing of the sort. We allow people to simply, and members of the clergy, as I mentioned before, to simply share with the camera, if you will, what their notion is, what their belief is, what their understanding of what God really is. We resisted mightily the temptation to turn the film into a I'm going to tell you how things are movie. Rather, we wanted to make it a pure documentary that whose main purpose was simply to explore the varying views of people around the earth, and why, for that matter, they hold those views. Members of the clergy were particularly specific about that, because we asked priests, we asked rabbis, we asked ulamas and others in the clergy, why do you think that? What makes you say that? What do you use as the basis for your pronouncements and your understandings? So no, the point of the film is simply to allow humanity to examine itself. You watch the film and you say, now I see. I'm seeing now. And, you know, what people think about God. And frankly, to be honest with you, when I watch the film, not all, of course, but many of the opinions are almost absurd when you listen to them. And in a sense, I'm hoping that we hold a mirror up to ourselves and that we can walk away from the film shaking our heads and going, I'm starting to get it. I'm starting to see why we are having these enormous difficulties on the planet. I'm starting to see why there are so many wars, so many millions of people who have been killed throughout human history based on our understandings and our disagreements with regard to the subject of God. And there's got to be a way to move from that primitive response and reaction to each other to a new way of being with each other inside the mystery of this thing that we call divinity.
When people begin to understand what God is, and I think we can understand that a little bit better as we evolve, does that change them as people?
I've never known anyone who did not change as a person. It causes us to react, respond to ourselves, that is, respond to our own thoughts and our own actions, our own past, in an entirely different way. And it causes us, of course, to respond to others in an entirely different way as well, including the absolute elimination of the experience of forgiveness from our lives. What I have come to a place of is in my life, because of the understanding that my conversations with God brought me, I've eliminated forgiveness as part of my human experience. Because I was told directly, and I see how it works in my life, understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master.
Hmm. Now, explain that, though. That doesn't mean you don't care for people, because I know you do.
Oh, of course not. Precisely because you do care for people, you realize that forgiveness is unnecessary in the space of understanding. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. The 3-year-old child reaches across the table at her birthday party because the cake has been placed in the middle of the table, and she's so excited about that chocolate cake, she's been waiting for 3 days for it, that she reaches across the table to just grab that cake and knocks over all the milk and creates a whole mess.
Right.
So the father doesn't have to forgive the child. The father doesn't say, oh, sweetheart, I forgive you. No. And the reason that the father doesn't have to forgive the 3-year-old is because the father perfectly well understands what could cause a 3-year-old child to have done that.
Right. And she really didn't do anything wrong.
No, of course not. So the same is true with all of us. We are, in fact, like 3-year-olds, as I mentioned. When we see ourselves in that purity, in that innocence, that we imagine ourselves to be doing what is quote-unquote right, that we imagine ourselves to be doing what needs to be done in order to get what we are trying to get in order to do the thing that we call survive, and to protect what we think we need to protect, all those principles, all those stories we tell each other about life itself, when we look at that from the standpoint of one who stands just a little bit distant from it and deeply understands how a person could do anything the way things are being done on this planet, even the most horrible things, when we understand that, we then move to a place of compassion precisely because we care for that person, not because we don't care, and because we realize then that forgiveness is totally inappropriate in the mind of the master. Because that notion of forgiveness suggests that the master himself or herself has somehow been damaged or destroyed. But that's not possible. Therefore, we understand the positionality of God itself. That God doesn't forgive anybody for anything because God can't be hurt or damaged or destroyed or upset or angered or frustrated in any way. Therefore, God has no reason to forgive anyone. But God simply understands perfectly well how a human being could and might do certain things. And from that place of understanding, God moves into that person's life with great compassion. I recall a few years ago that the previous pope, I think it might have been 2 popes back in my history, memory serves me correctly, who was nearly assassinated in a parade and as he was driving through Rome. And a man stepped forward and shot him, and he almost died. He was severely wounded in the stomach. Somebody can probably tell me, I think it was Pope John Paul, but I'm not certain. In any event, he was taken to the hospital, the pope was. He was rushed into surgery, and he survived.
Yeah. It was John Paul II, and we'll come right back, Neil, with more.